From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We were overwhelmed with signatures from all over Illinois. It's always nice to have your 10,000 good ones in early, and the rest is gravy, and we are so grateful to everybody that signed our petition and passed our petition.
You know, it's strategic. You want to be in the lottery to have your name first on the ballot, but it's also tradition. It's a fun part of the campaign and being here.
Myself and my running mate, we've traveled the state, you know, two or three or four different times. And most of the people we talk to, everybody has one thing in common. It's time to bring an end to Quinn. Quinn has failed policies that have not worked for the common working class people in Illinois.
The people of Illinois should never let anybody buy the governorship, and it's buyer beware. But we've seen and been bamboozled in Illinois by guys like Dan Walker and Rod Blagojevich before.
I've been outspent every election I've run, practically. 7-1 in the last Republican primary by one person, 4-1 against one of my competitors. Money doesn't win these elections. What wins the election is resonates with the people, the voters, and our grassroots organization and our positions on the issues.
A smattering of the candidates for Illinois governor as it was filing for the spring primaries this past week in Illinois. Well, we heard in there Senator Kirk Dillard, a Republican from Hinsdale, candidate for governor, and Senator Bill Brady, a Republican from Bloomington. We also heard from Democratic candidate for governor T.O. Hardeman, who will be running against Pat Quinn. We also heard Dillard and Brady again criticizing the wealth of another Republican gubernatorial candidate, Bruce Rauner. Elections for the spring primaries and details of the pension proposal emerge. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel on State Week includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at UIS, Amanda Venicky, State House Bureau Chief for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio, Brian Mackey, State House Reporter for WUIS and IPR. Our guest this week, Kurt Erickson, State House Bureau Chief for Lee Enterprises, which includes papers in Bloomington, Decatur, Carbondale, and the Quad Cities. Kurt, thanks for coming along this week.
You're welcome.
Well, first it's election filing, so let's get down. We had the candidates for governor we expected on the Republican side, and I would say we had an additional filing on the Democratic side, although not totally unexpected. So give us a quick summary of that, Amanda Venicky.
Yes, as you said, Bill, the individuals that we heard from at the top of the program were the candidates running for governor who made live appearances themselves. There's a tradition in the state of being in line. Some people, in fact, had been waiting in line. The rumor is as late as Thursday night, even, to be around for the Monday 8 a.m. filing. Anybody who is there by 8 o'clock in the morning has a chance at the first spot on the ballot. And as you heard from Senator Bill Brady there, tradition, but also wisdom is that gives a candidate a little bit more of a shot of getting a couple of extra voters who sign off on the very first name that they see. So those are the ones who made appearances. But everybody who is expected to run for governor at least got their signatures in by that point in time.
And candidates still have until next week to file. And but was
so there, we could see more.
It is always possible. Anything that was notable at this particular event rather than just people standing in line and a few politicians trying to get attention of reporters?
You know, what I think is interesting about it is that just the atmosphere of it. It's almost, I think, is almost like a cocktail party or something, unlike fundraisers where people are, drinking and schmoozing, what have you, or it's everybody from one party or everybody behind one candidate. This, you have the opponents all getting together, not necessarily speaking to each other. They're all surrounded by their teams. Everybody's bundled up and casual. It's just sort of a different atmosphere than you typically see proxy candidates in. It was interesting to speak with. We heard from, for example, T.O. Hardeman, the Democrat who put his name in the ring to run against the incumbent, Pat Quinn. And that was really the first appearance, at least that I'm aware of, where he has been downstate. So that was interesting, at least for those of us who are based in Springfield, to speak with him. Hardeman, of course, is the former program director for Ceasefire, an anti-violence program, but was, he says the appropriate term is not ousted, but is no longer in that position after some domestic violence disputes. That said, he has a woman as his running mate, a woman who said that she spoke with Hardeman's wife. Hardeman's wife wasn't actually at the State Board of Elections building itself, but he said was in Springfield with him and supports his candidacy. And he, that said, Hardeman hasn't gotten any, you know, support from Democrats, really. So you're seeing the entire, basically, Democratic apparatus back incumbent Pat Quinn. But I'd say those are really kind of the most interesting things at the top of the ballot. It's also just watching who else files in some of the other races, what incumbents in the General Assembly are getting opposition, because that's actually a really rare thing. For the most part, they don't get challenged.
It also is was sort of remarkable for who wasn't there. If you go back to this summer and recall that we were talking about Bill Daley, well, he wasn't there. He's dropped out of the race, and it's a good reminder to not get too excited about some of these possible candidates, or definitely not call them official candidates until the filing day actually comes and passes.
Kurt, you live rather close to the State Board of Elections as you drove back and forth from the candy shop or whatever. Did you see people hanging outside the door of that place in the couple of days prior?
Yeah, I actually made it a point to kind of drive through the parking lot on my way, you know, to the fitness center and other healthy endeavors. And there were there were people sitting there, in the, and it was very cold. I think one of the days it did get into the teens as far as the temperature goes. And there were they had lawn chairs, and I'm sure they could kind of, you know, ask somebody to hold their place and whatnot. But they were sitting out there starting at least on Thursday.
It's funny. Once I went out at, I don't know, I think it was 2 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't this year. It was 2 years ago now, to interview people that had gotten there so very early and, you know, put my microphone in front of their face. And it turned out to be people that I knew from the Capitol, but they were so bundled up that I wasn't able to recognize them. So when I said, "What's your name?" And they're like, "Amanda." Hello. So it is kind of funny. I think that they planned that. But the remarkable thing about it is that as long as you're in line by 8 a.m., you don't have to do all of that. So we asked Tim Mapes, who is the go-to guy for House Speaker Mike Madigan, and it was Madigan and, well, Madigan, the speaker himself, was not there, but he was there, as well as Mike Casper, who has been, you know, the longtime party attorney for Madigan, and a lot of the House Democratic staffers as well that had been first in line. They, you know, they wouldn't really cop to necessarily why it was necessary to do all of that, because they could have shown up at 7:59 a.m. I think that it's a matter of pride and prestige, maybe scaring the opponent a little bit, perhaps a form of proving loyalty and worth, particularly for people that are just getting started. But there's no need to do any of that.
Well, Amanda was, I think I read somewhere that the first person in line was someone who was going to be filing petitions for House Democrats on behalf of the speaker.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
That, to me, that symbolism says a lot about Mike Madigan and, mm-hmm. you know, why he is where he is and why he's been there that long. And I think you were exactly right when you said that there's kind of prestige involved in being number one in line. And so the report I read had his people showing up Thursday night to be ready to file on Monday. And I mean, that's the kind of, what would you say, turnout you would expect people maybe lining up to watch, to get tickets to watch Alabama and Auburn this weekend.
Well, and we should add, I think, that, you know, one of the things that turning in these signatures does, right, there's a minimum signature requirement to get on the ballot. Most of these candidates are going to be turning in a lot more than that because there's also a political sport in Illinois that's going to be coming where people challenge each other and try to knock their opponents off the ballot. There was a young state senator who managed to get a clear shot at the Democratic primary many years ago named Barack Obama because he was able to knock his opponent off the ballot. So this is, I mean, there is an important aspect as well as the sort of political sport here. And, you know, somebody who shows up that early and is that ready to go and files first thing on the first day, I think is sending a message to their opponents. Sure, you can spend your time going through thousands of names on all my petitions, but we have our ducks in a row. And somebody who maybe shows up later in the week, turns it in later, you know, that I think it can be viewed by some, at least. I'm not saying this is a fact, but by some can view that as a sign of weakness. Maybe you didn't have as strong an organization as you thought you would going into this.
And sometimes people do it just to kind of needle somebody else. There was a situation back when I was a reporter 20-some years ago where a Republican state senator from the North Shore, a guy named Roger Keats, filed the bare minimum number of signatures for the Republican primary that particular year. Well, people working for Senate President Phil Rock, a Democrat, challenged some of those signatures and got his petitions thrown out. So Keats had to run in the Republican primary as a write-in, and he got nominated. There were no other candidates, as I recall. But it was just kind of a lesson that there's partisanship involved, and you can't just take stuff for granted. And if you start to take stuff for granted, somebody's going to stick it to you.
And when it comes to the political race, they decided to make hay when one of the candidates released some of his financials, and it showed he made a lot of money, Kurt Erickson.
Yeah, Bruce Rauner kind of beat everyone to the punch by releasing his financial disclosure forms and his tax returns, showing that in 2012 he earned $53 million. The year before, it was, I believe, 28 or 27. The year before, it was $26 million.
Paltry.
So
really tough year.
He kind of jumped in, you know, got in front of it. It was a pretty nice masterstroke because wealth is going to be the issue for the guy from his opponents. And before they could start calling on him to release his income tax returns, he did it on a day when a lot of attention was being placed on the filing day. So he kind of was able to bury it a little bit. It's also right before Thanksgiving, so the general public is maybe thinking more about turkey shopping and watching football.
People get the paper and they go straight for the coupons this time of year, I think, sometimes. You know,
yeah, but on the other hand,
this is
a story that's going to be ongoing. And
absolutely.
In my mind, it doesn't matter when it got released. The fact that here's a guy who last year earned 1,000 times the median income of people in Illinois, and he's still trying to portray himself as sort of Joe Sixpack. He has an $18 watch. He's also got a penthouse in New York. He's got a penthouse, or not a penthouse, but he's got condos in Chicago. He's got ranches out west. He's got a place in the Florida Keys. And he actually lives in Winnetka. I think it's kind of disingenuous to expect people to buy this, oh, I'm just a regular guy kind of thing. You know, he's put $1.5 million roughly into his own campaign. And if you kind of scale it down, that would be the equivalent of someone with median income setting aside $1,500 for themselves for a campaign.
You know, and there's so many different ways to look at this statistically. Charlie mentioned 1,000 times the average Illinois income. You know, I was curious. We heard a lot a few years ago about the 99% and the 1%. Well, I thought, well, surely he's in the 1%, but actually he's well within the 0.1%. I looked up according to the 2012 tax, you know, income distribution, in order to get in the 99.9%, you have to, you know, above that threshold, you have to make $2 million, and he made 53. So he is well well in that. I mean, it's sort of mind-boggling trying to describe this wealth. And one thing that I think is very telling is you look at his tax forms, and on the line, it's line 7 on the federal 1040 tax form where you put in your W-2 income. I think pretty safe to say that all of us on this program get W-2s from our respective employers, and you know that is where the bulk of our income is. His is blank, and all of his income is from interest and capital gains and real estate and other things like that. This is what, when people say, I use this in a story this week, but when people say, don't work for your money, make your money work for you, this is what they're talking about.
Well, and what you got in the press release, so two things here. First of all, Bruce Rauner, again, was not there himself to file his petitions, and he has been in Springfield, made a speech to a local Republican group, came down for the state fair. But really, reporters here have not had a chance to speak with him in terms of policy. And that has been clearly his weakness. He's proven himself to be a hard worker, to have been strategic, such as with this release in terms of the campaign perspective. But he has not yet shown his credentials in terms of knowing the actual issues. It's easy to say, I'm going to reform state government, I'm going to make everything better, without actually saying how. And that is an area that we haven't seen proven out and didn't have that chance. So again, this was all came just via a statement, via an emailed press release, in which Rauner said, quote, I can't be bought or intimidated by the special interests, which I think is something that we need to read into. Clearly, He is showing by how much of his own personal money he has put into the campaign that is the case. He doesn't necessarily need to bow down to unions, as you, for example, may have seen, or to certain business interests, as you have seen candidates do throughout. That said, you look at who else is giving to his campaign, and it's clear that he has some very close business interests that are aligned with his own kind of strata, that other 0.1%. He's got money from Ken Griffin, the richest man in Illinois, for example. He may not need their money because he has his own, but they certainly have close ties and relationships. Put your money in a blind trust or not, you still have a whole lot of money there. And if he ever were to be, become governor or a more than just a candidate in Illinois, there are plenty of special interests that need to be dealt with in order to get things done and accomplished.
You're listening to State Week. Just ahead, details of the pension proposal that could be voted upon next week are discussed.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, providing professional services to Illinois lawyers and education and services to the public. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Vinicky, Brian Mackey, and Lee Enterprises' Kurt Erickson. We taped this program on Wednesday afternoon due to the Thanksgiving holiday, and we do know that a deal has been reached regarding pensions among Illinois legislative leaders. Not all of the details are out yet, many of those set to be released on Friday, but we'll talk about what we know so far on the show. We'll start with Amanda Vinicky. Amanda?
Well, as you said, Bill, really the details are still emerging, and so it's hard to get legislators to really weigh in and say if there are going to be a yes or a no vote. But we do have broad outlines, and it's largely what we've been hearing for quite some time in terms of this. A lot of the savings really come from doing away with the compounded 3% COLA, at least for most employees. For those who earn less, potentially under $30,000, it appears, they may be still receiving something along those lines. But for most people, it will be instead tied to inflation. That's what will determine their retirement payout. It also is said to include some sort of something akin to a 401k style plan, at least as an option. Younger employees will, it appears, have to work longer before they would be able to draw on a pension benefit. So raising the retirement age, but not necessarily for those who are actually close to retirement. And in exchange for all of those things that would decrease the worth of a state public pension, so that would be, of course, course, affecting state workers, university employees, such as admittedly myself, and public school teachers, anybody will give less of their paycheck toward their retirement benefits. So not much less, just a decrease of about 1%.
So one percentage point less would be taken out of an employee's checks, and then there would also be the cost of living would essentially for many people be tied to, for the retirees, be tied to inflation rather than a set amount every year.
Exactly, rather than this three-pounded 3% compounded cost of living adjustment that many critics say is what has exacerbated the cost. Of course, you hear from unions who are already fighting this and saying that they will not go along with it, that it is unconstitutional, that it is not that COLA that is to blame, rather that it is the state for so many years not putting in its contribution toward the pension systems that has left Illinois with the worst in the nation, $100 billion unfunded pension liability.
Other points that we should know about, Brian Mackey?
Yeah, well, as Amanda said, I mean, I guess at this point, there's still so much that we don't know about this deal. And I think one of the important things to keep in mind is that it's not clear. So the leaders have reached an agreement, right? But it's not yet clear to me how many of their members there are willing to go along and how many arms are going to have to be twisted in order to make this happen. We've known that Senate President Cullerton has had this idea of consideration, offer and acceptance under contract law, which is where you have to give the employees something in order to take these benefits away from them. And it's not clear to me, obviously, again, we can't say this enough, we don't have the details yet, but what component of that is in there? A lot of his members kind of bought into that argument. He was very wrapped up and invested in it. And it's, it remains to be seen how much arm twisting he and the Republicans, for that matter, are going to be willing to do.
And don't forget, Governor Pat Quinn might also want to jump in and maybe try to convince those who need convincing. I think one of the more interesting things I will be doing next week, hopefully I will have time, is sitting out front of the governor's office and seeing who walks in his door. And then when they walk out, asking them what the governor has decided to give them, whether that's a some kind of pork project or what.
So this is going to be a vote in the legislature where they don't necessarily have the votes in hand as they plan this vote.
No, this has really been a very tightly closed doors. Oftentimes you have leaks about what's happening behind when the legislative leaders meet, or perhaps involvement from members of the conference committee. It really has appeared to have just been the four legislative leaders. So they're just getting to the point of talking really to the rank and file members and, as has been said, twisting those arms. I do think it is important to point out that Governor Pat Quinn, who has been very vague always on pensions, just saying that he wants something to happen, just what that is, hasn't really ever come to terms with. He's put out a statement saying that, yes, he does think that this plan meets the, again, limited criteria that he had set forth, and that he says it will do away with the unfunded liability and stabilize the pension systems. It's clear that he wants something done. First of all, of course, he's running for re-election. He has put so much personal stake into this, but also his budget for next year that he'll be called upon to introduce and has to introduce according to state law with some tie to reality will see some very major cuts without a pension agreement or something that would reduce the state's costs settled.
I was talking to a few Republicans earlier, and they said they don't think the Speaker and the Senate President would be calling all the lawmakers back on Tuesday if they didn't have the votes.
Yeah, it would make them look a lot less powerful than they are. So we'll get to see. That said, I think this is really a very tough vote for legislators. They will know at the point in time that the General Assembly is called to session, so Tuesday the 3rd, that's after the filing deadline, so they will know if they face any competition in a primary. Nonetheless, unions don't like this, and I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, there are teachers in every district, and particularly in a lot of downstate districts where more of the voters are come from a government background and unions are very powerful, less so and have given less to Madigan, for example, over the years. But that's going to be something that I think around the Thanksgiving table, everybody will have spent plenty of time talking about. Anybody who has a relative that works in government, hearing back from them saying, no, 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 don't go for this. And that's the umbrella that this will all be under.
And if it does pass, obviously, court is the next step.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty clear that there will be a court challenge here. The unions have promised as much. Probably this wouldn't go into effect until next summer. And so we would have to wait until that time before we'd even get a court challenge, which raises the interesting question of how this plays out in the budgeting process next year. Of course, the tax increase, the so-called temporary tax increase, is set to expire halfway through the next budget year. The purpose of doing these pensions is to relieve the pressure on spending, the amount of money that has to go towards pensions now by reducing these benefits for retirees. They don't have to pay as much toward it now, and then they can spend more on education and prisons and other things that the state does. And will they sort of say, oh, look, we've saved all this money through pensions in the budgeting process next year, even though a court challenge could come along that might throw this out? Because as we can't say enough, the Illinois Constitution says pension benefits shall not be diminished, and it remains to be seen how that works with this.
I think it's interesting that this came along on the day before Thanksgiving, and it's going to all happen over a holiday weekend. This is sort of normal operating procedure for big issues in Springfield.
Yeah, something gets squeaked in under the radar at the very last minute when not a lot of people are paying attention, sure.
Something that legislators are already upset about. They're saying, sure, even if we get the broad outline of the deal on Friday, the legislation needs to be drafted. If they get it on Monday, this is going to be a 300, 400-page bill, presumably. How do you get to read into that and really understand what all it will mean and the ramifications it will have in that short a time?
Time to go for some notes from the field. I'll start with Charlie Wheeler.
Well, President Obama earlier this week okayed the request from Governor Quinn to have 15 Illinois counties declared as disaster areas in the wake of the tornadoes. And this declaration would make available to affected homeowners and businesses low-cost loans, temporary housing grants, money for home repairs, and other kinds of things to try and help restore normalcy to the folks who were so devastated by the tornadoes a week ago.
Kurt Erickson.
Bruce Rauner reported $53 million in income in 2012. I was looking at some of the different state agencies and what their budgets were, and I saw that Eastern Illinois University was got a $44 million appropriation from the state. So Rauner could have paid for Eastern Illinois this year and then just had $9 million left over to live on.
That's what you call
campaign.
A good scholarship program.
How much was his state income taxes? Was a couple million dollars, right? So that would have covered some of the small agencies totally.
Amanda Vinicky. Right.
We did see, speaking of the governor's race, a poll come out from Public Policy Polling that put Rauner that said that Governor Pat Quinn, is actually going to have a very tough time holding on to his seat, but he did do better than last year when Governor Pat Quinn was the least popular governor in the nation. He's no longer that, and actually saw his popularity in Illinois increase a wee little bit.
Brian Mackey.
Yeah, there was a story in the State Journal Register and Springfield's newspaper this week about them possibly moving the many statues that are on the Capitol lawn. They're kind of all spread out. Some of them are kind of peons to interest groups. Some are politicians, putting them in one big row. But I'm not as interested in that. You can question whether the state should be spending money on a project like that at a time like this, when it's a time of austerity. But I just use this as a point to talk about my favorite past Illinois governor who has a statue out there, John Palmer. There's a pretty good Wikipedia page on him. He was a member of five different political parties in his lifetime. Civil War general, fascinating guy. You will have the most interesting discussion, with your family this weekend if you go spend some time reading about John Palmer.
That's our time for this edition of State Week. Thanks to Kurt Erickson of Lee Enterprises for joining us this week. Production assistance for today's program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.